I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Beth Beverly is a rogue taxidermist who uses her skills to make fashion and art out of bird, reptile, and animal carcasses and body parts. She was a competitor on AMC's taxidermy show called Immortalized. In their press material, she's quoted as saying, "While other people come upon roadkill and see a dead animal, I see a hat." She has a studio in Kensington, and she joins us today on Radio Times. And Beth Beverly, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
It's so great to be here. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Rachel Poliquin. She wrote a book about the history of taxidermy called The Breathless Zoo, Taxidermy and the Culture of Longing. She's a curator and writer. She blogs at ravishingbeast.com. And Rachel, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
No, it's great to be here.
Let me begin with you, Beth, if I could. And perhaps you could describe your earrings for our listeners.
Well, today I'm wearing a pair of joined earrings, and on one side is a rat skull from a hairless rat that I mounted for a client a couple years ago.
And with a kind of a thread and then a regular earring on the other side.
Correct, yeah. Just joined, like a necklace almost.
What's a rogue taxidermist?
A rogue taxidermist is a term that I think has come up in recent years to describe the more artistic side of taxidermy. There's a whole kind of troop of people popping up who like to do the taxidermy, but also incorporate unusual elements and give nature a bit of a twist. And that would be rogue.
And that would be rogue. Now, you did study, official or formal taxidermy, yes?
Correct. I went to the Pocono Institute of Taxidermy in 2010.
Let me go to you, Rachel, because you've written a book about the history of taxidermy. Would you say we're in a kind of taxidermy renaissance or revival?
Oh, very much so. I originally got into this project because I love anything obsolete or outdated or irrelevant, and I thought taxidermy was exactly that. Because I love those old natural history museums with the old crusty creatures that are kind of irrelevant, I thought, and were outdated. And I had no idea that there was this huge flourishing of taxidermy when I got into it, and people were doing rogue taxidermy, and it's a really interesting movement, I think.
Your book is subtitled The Cultures of Longing, that there's something about longing in taxidermy. Flesh that out for us.
The way I argue that is that as an organic being, whether you're a human, an animal, or a plant, what it means to be organic is that you're born, you die, you materially disappear, you decompose, and that's the end of you. Mm-hmm. And to me, because taxidermy takes so much time and effort and manipulation, the desire to hold something back from that inevitable dissolution, to me, exudes a peculiar sort of longing to go to this effort to keep this creature.
To a longing for some kind of immortality, I mean, to exist beyond one's death, for instance?
Well, exactly. And my book is divided into seven chapters that I call narratives of longing. So various ways that humans have really desired to hold, or reasons humans have desired to hold these things back. So an encounter with nature's wonder or nature's beauty, or a desire to tell a story about yourself with the natural world. And I think it's a really powerful energy.
Did you ever think about being a taxidermist? Did that ever cross your mind?
No, actually not. And that's one of the more interesting misconceptions about this book, is most people think I am a taxidermist.
Right.
And I have never made anything far too squeamish.
You don't want to?
No, I thought at the beginning when I started the project I would be a method academic, you know, and I got a video on how to mount a cougar, which was probably the wrong video to begin with because it completely horrified me, and that was it. And in fact, I don't really own any taxidermy. People give me taxidermy,
yeah, I was wondering about that.
And I repurpose it to better homes, mostly because all my taxidermy seems to get the moth, and I have destroyed entire wardrobes of clothing with my taxidermy, so well, I pass it on.
I will pick up on that, but let me go back to you, Beth Beverly, because you are a taxidermist. When and how did you get interested in taxidermy?
I've always incorporated animal fibers into my art, and I think the real impetus behind taking on the task of taxidermy was working at Daffy's, actually, as a window dresser downtown.
This is in downtown Philadelphia, yeah.
Yeah, good memories.
Yeah.
And And I would see all these birds that had crashed into windows and they were just lying on the sidewalk. And it broke my heart to see them just kind of shoved into the street or stepped on. And so I, without even really thinking, I just bought a book on basic taxidermy and started picking these birds up and taking them home to play with them. And it just seemed like the natural thing to do.
But were you a little kid that, that played outside, I mean, that liked being in nature and what might come across, a skull or something and be interested?
Absolutely. I was always collecting shells and rocks and snakeskins and beehives and anything and trying to make it wearable.
So what was the first thing you maybe unofficially taxidermed? Is that a word, taxidermed?
Sure. I'm always struggling to find just the right word.
What the right word is.
Before I went to school, after I played with the birds that I'd find for a little bit, I went to the butcher and bought a rabbit with the skin still on, and I gave the rabbit some pigeon wings, and gave him like a little pearl horn, and he was just this flying rabbit. He was awful. Too.
Awful meaning what?
Just terrible
taxidermy. Freaky looking or?
Because I wasn't formally trained. So I made really bad taxidermy for about 10 years before I went to school.
When you were making it, did you think it was good or that's something you've learned as a result of going to
school?
Now
that I look back, I see how awful it was. But at the time, it was so exciting to me to be kind of teaching myself this new craft and figuring it out on my own and figuring out the anatomy of an animal and getting my hands dirty into it. So it was so exciting. I didn't care.
But it must be so interesting to see an animal sort of from the inside out. I mean, there you are. You're really seeing how an animal is made. I mean, what's inside of them, which is something most people don't even think about.
I really do like that part because there's so many scent glands and all the skulls are made quite differently. And it's good to see, literally what makes an animal tick.
As you said, it's interesting you used the word play. You were working at Daffy's and you saw these dead birds on the sidewalk as a result of flying into buildings and took them home to play with them.
That's what it felt like at first. I think that's what makes art fun for me is if I just play and that's when the best things come out.
Yeah. And getting to know this bird and turning it over, taking it apart, then repurposing it.
Exactly.
Let me go back to you, Rachel, and I'm just curious about the sort of history of taxidermy, and it seems like it goes back a couple of centuries to when humans began to really explore the world.
Yeah, very much so. Taxidermy really dates to sort of the post-Columbus adventure era, when people were going out from Europe and they were going to these distant lands across the ocean. And without some form, I mean, this was obviously in an age before photography or Discovery Channel or any of those things in kind of the 16th, 17th century. And without some form of preservation to bring this thing home, they could never show people at home what exotic creatures and wonderful things they had discovered abroad. And so very rudimentary taxidermy began really to preserve those encounters with nature's wonders, nature's most exotic and wondrous things.
And I'm wondering about that early taxidermy. I mean, just how rudimentary
was
that? It's hard to imagine it would survive a trip across an ocean, for instance.
Well, that was the thing. A lot of animals, they did really try to bring them back alive, but they would die en route because no one knew what they needed to eat, or maybe the sailors just got hungry, who knows. And a lot of the very early taxidermy instructions include you would take the guts out of the animal, and then you would bake it in an oven. So you can
imagine. The animal or the guts?
The animal.
The animal.
Just to stop the insects coming in and getting it. You can imagine it being so moist aboard a seagoing vessel. And then they would actually apply tar to the inside of the skin, again, to just halts decomposition and stop any of the insects. You can imagine this oven-baked, tarred creature coming back to these collectors. But that was a wonder, you know, that was an exotic creature.
Well, I have to say, when you said baked, Beverly, your eyes just went, what? were they thinking, right?
It seems such a horrific thing to do. But yeah, I guess if you don't know what else to do. Someone had to start somewhere.
Yeah, and it was always the insects that caused the problem. And so there's even manuals that say once you've taken the bread out of the oven, so the oven has reached that perfect temperature, you'd put a chicken feather in. Huh. And if the chicken feather was singed, then you knew it was too hot to put your exotic bird of paradise or something in. And so you kept testing with chicken feathers until the chicken feather didn't singe, and then you'd leave your beast in there for 4 hours or something.
But it sounds like it didn't actually work.
It didn't work. They were horrible.
And then the tar, obviously, just to sort of cover the insides to make sure it didn't decompose, I guess, even
exactly.
more.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But that's, I mean, we're talking 17th century stuff. That's right. Very, very early.
All right. Well, let me jump to the 21st century and I'll go back to you, Beth. I'm just curious about how the sort of basics of taxidermy today in terms of how you work. Where do you start?
Well, the most basic thing is removing all the flesh from the specimen. You want to just essentially turn the entire hide or skin inside out. Anything, any kind of flesh, any tissue. Sometimes you keep the bones in. Sometimes you use some of the bones. Sometimes none. It all depends on what animal you're working with and exactly what you're trying to do. But that's the main idea, is get anything that can rot out of that creature, and then you proceed to treating the skin or tanning it, whatever method you want to use to preserve it. There's so many different ways, and every taxidermist kind of has their own methods.
Yeah, and the tools, I'm assuming, very exacting knives, for instance?
Yeah, surgical steel. I have a surgical steel blade. And sometimes, I mean, you can just use X-Acto knives and things like that. And the tools are very similar to dental tools and,
so yeah. Picking away at a carcass, for instance.
Yeah, there's a little thing called a brain spoon.
What's a brain spoon?
It's a little tiny scooper, basically. And it's for scooping out the brains of birds and their eyes and whatnot.
And what do you do with that? The brains, do you... make earrings out of it? So you've got that skull hanging from one of your earlobes?
Yeah, you know, sometimes the skulls are really cool, so I save them. And you can actually use the brains of an animal to tan the hide, too. So that's a whole other practice.
Right. To actually tan the hide using
You make a paste out of the brain, and you apply it as a... You brush it on like a regular tanning agent. And it works. I've tried it.
And talking about flesh, and we're almost up in a break here, I'm assuming, we're talking about taxidermy. I mean, the more fat there is, maybe the harder it is to get the flesh out, so to speak?
It's a bit more labor-intensive. Like a raccoon, for example, they have very fatty skin. But if you have the right tools, it can actually be a fun workout to just manually scrape for an hour or so.
A physical workout?
Yes. It's good for the core.
That's Beth Beverly, I should say. She's a rogue taxidermist, an artist, owner, and proprietor of Diamond Tooth Taxidermy, which is here, in Philadelphia, in the Kensington section of Philadelphia. Also with us, Rachel Poliquin, a curator, writer, author of The Breathless Zoo, Taxidermy, and the Cultures of Longing. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Camp Hill Special School with day and residential options is a community committed to the care and education of children ages 4 through 21 with mild to severe intellectual disabilities. Dr. Dan Gottlieb makes a presentation at their Phoenixville campus on April 22nd, and the school hosts an open house at their Glenmore campus on April 27th. To register for the presentation on April 22nd and the open house on April 27th, and for more details, camphillspecialschool.org.
WHYY's Quiet Campaign is underway. Do your part now to take a day off the start of our spring on-air membership drive. Make your gift at whyy.org/support. Our goal is to raise $25,000 before midnight on Tuesday. And if we make that goal, we'll keep Pledge Central quiet all day Wednesday. Join the Quiet Campaign. Make your gift now at whyy.org/support.
Before Philly musician Kurt Vile joined the lo-fi revival of the last decade, he paid his dues as a forklift driver.
Lucky for us, he's abandoned the gear shift for the guitar, and he joins us this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about taxidermy this hour of Radio Times. In fact, if you go to whyy.org/radiotimes, our homepage there, we have posted photos of taxidermy, including some that are done by our guest Beth Beverly, a rogue taxidermist, and some that are featured in Rachel Poliquin's book called The Breathless Zoo. You can also call us at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Any taxidermy stories, do give us a call. Rachel, if I can go back to you, and I found very interesting in your book the whole description of Victorians and their interest in nature and animals, and of course taxidermy as well.
Yeah, the Victorian era really saw the heyday of taxidermy. They just absolutely loved nature to death. They collected animals, and it isn't really an inconsistency to say that in order to appreciate animals longer, they killed them so that they would be able to decorate their homes with them. And they created extraordinary pieces, these huge glass domes that would be 7 feet tall, filled with 100 birds, and they just wanted to be surrounded by the beauty of the natural world.
And they seem to be particularly interested in hummingbirds. There's a beautiful picture in this book of a cabinet with just filled with hummingbirds.
Yeah, their relationship with hummingbirds I find particularly fascinating, in that what they thought was so beautiful about the bird was its perpetual motion and the way that those emeralds and rubies and topazes would shift and flirt as the bird moved. But they never saw a living hummingbird because mm-hmm. they never survived that transatlantic journey, because hummingbirds are just an American species. So to see a hummingbird necessarily meant that they were seeing a mummified relic of a bird that encapsulated liveliness. So I really use that as an example of one of the longings that they had, that longing for beauty, which was totally impossible to fulfill.
But nonetheless, an intense curiosity about nature and how nature worked, and wanting to examine nature under glass, I guess, as opposed to in the real world.
Well, they did both. They were kind of the two strands of the same component of their nature love. And the kind of the weird component of it is they probably knew nature better than we do today. They knew the names of the birds that were in their backyards. They knew the names of the ferns that were growing. They knew it so much better, but they had no problems with killing it in order to bring it into the home. Whereas I think we have more of a nature preservation sensibility, but I would wonder how many people actually know the names of their birds in their backyard anymore.
Fair enough. You do include in this book also two pictures of ocelots. One is, you know, very well preserved and I guess taxidermied, and the other just looks a wreck.
Well, exactly. The one that's a wreck is from 1818, and it was modeled by a taxidermist who had no idea what a living ocelot actually looked like. And so he just sort of stuffed it together, and the skin is kind of all stuffed out and has got a little bloated body and little sticky legs, and his face is just a horrific caricature. But in some ways, that's now 200 years old. So who knows what it may have looked like 200 years ago, but skin shrinks and cracks with age and time. So, but that really shows how far taxidermy has improved in the last 200 years, for sure.
Let me go back to you, Beth. And as you were describing to us your interest in nature and these birds that you found on the street, and then deciding what at some point I really need to get some skills, become, I guess, a professional when it comes to taxidermy.
Right. It kind of was just a hobby for about 10 years, and it never occurred to me that I could make this a profession. And I thought I was going to be a window dresser for my entire life, basically, and just sort of play with taxidermy. And then after 10 years or so, it wasn't going away, and I really wanted to get better, basically. And so I just took the plunge and lived in the Poconos for a few months by myself in a cabin with no internet and no TV, and was completely immersed in taxidermy all day.
I should say, for a while you were window dresser at Daffy's, which sadly closed about a year ago. But those windows were famous in terms of just the theater, the drama, all the things that you and I guess others used for Daffy's.
Right. It was really fun. And I actually, there was one window that was my favorite because I turned a mannequin into a centaur. So the fascination with animals has always been there. And right. It was really neat just to have a boss who would kind of give me the green light to do whatever I wanted.
So creating really a whole new creature, right, out of parts.
Exactly, and putting a ball gown on it.
The pièce de résistance. So what did you learn at this taxidermy place in the Poconos?
All basic foundation skills. And I kind of kept my artistic inclinations to myself while I was in school. I really just wanted to learn the basic foundation of what I would need in order to then pursue a more rogue side of right. taxidermy. So we started with pheasants and we moved on to fox, we did fish, deer, basically we rugs, and like the whole basic commercial taxidermy. Right.
And who were your fellow students?
I was surprised.
And maybe they're rogue taxidermists and you don't know it either, right?
I showed up to class on the first day expecting to come into a room full of, young men wearing camo. And there was one other student, and it was a 60-year-old grandmother.
Wow.
Who, her husband was a real big-time hunter and basically wanted an in-house taxidermist.
So that she could mount his...
Right. So he wouldn't have to send them outside right. or out of state or anything. And she was tired of waitressing, so... Hopefully, they're very successful together these days.
Well, let me pick up on that and go back to you, Rachel, because, again, in your book, lots of photos of either hunting lodges or people's houses with animals mm-hmm. taxidermied and on the wall.
Yes, exactly.
A trophy or perhaps as a kind of decor?
Well, that's certainly a really interesting component of this new interest in taxidermy that's sort of been growing over the past 10, 15 years, is it's becoming a much more en vogue home decor item. It's hard to open any decorating magazine these days or even to go into an upscale decorating store, and you'll encounter taxidermy mm-hmm. everywhere. And one of the big distinctions between, say, somebody who hunts and these sort of new interest is that they're always secondhand pieces. They're always vintage finds. They're not. So I find it's particularly interesting in places like New York, where you go into a shoe store and there'll be a kind of a Victorian fox looking out over the shoes, and it's a really interesting trend.
Yeah, I mean, do you think it's connected to that Victorian interest in taxidermy, or we've sort of reconfigured it for a modern age?
I think, like, as with any sort of fashion trend or aesthetic trend, it's really hard to pinpoint one reason why it's become so popular. I think this re-interest in nature, a sort of a shying away from things that are manufactured. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing about an animal is it's totally unique. It is that one particular creature, and it's beautiful, and it's sensuous, and it's textural. Whereas a lot of modern decor is serially produced. It's mass-produced. There's nothing unique about it. It's kind of smooth, perfect surfaces. It's minimal. And in some ways, those two things together are really extraordinarily beautiful when you kind of pair this very simple Barcelona chair with this beautiful antelope or something. It creates quite a aesthetic clash, if you will, that I think is really appealing to a lot of people.
And Beth, when you're doing your work, I mean, do you get a sense of the life of this animal, the story that might go along with this animal that you're working on?
I do. Well, I mean, I love animals, and I feel like when they're on my table, it's a very intimate experience. And especially with pets, I do pets occasionally. And so in those cases, I've got, you know, sometimes hundreds of photos of these animals in my emails from a client as reference. And I've got, usually a client will stay and talk to me for an hour or two and tell me stories about all their favorite moments with this animal. And so the whole time I'm working on it, even though I may have never met this animal when it was alive, I feel like I know it very, very well. Hmm. I know its life and its story.
So we talking about what, dogs, cats?
Both. Dogs and cats.
Is that eerie at all for you to take someone's pet and try to preserve it that way?
It's not so much eerie as it is, it's a very heavy responsibility to me, because if a hunter brings me a deer, they just met that deer in the moment that they dispatched it. But a dog that someone's had for 14 years, they've been staring into those eyes for hours and hours every day for the last 14 years. And so the task to recreate that facial expression is so much more, it's a Herculean task.
Well, I'm thinking, what do you use for eyes?
You can order glass eyes online, and there's every shape, color, size.
And Rachel sort of picks up on this, both alive and not alive, of taxidermy.
Yeah, all taxidermy really plays with that tension. And I think that what I'm always interested in is your encounter with this taxidermied animal, because it's really unlike any other animal encounter that you're going to have. Particularly with something that's dangerous. You can get right up close to a lion and you know it's never going to attack, and observe it more closely than you ever could. And as opposed to a photograph, you can really compare yourself physically to something that's very big or very little. And as Beth said, there's something very intimate in this encounter, whether you're, I imagine, if you're actually creating it, but afterwards with that animal.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. I do want to get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We're talking about taxidermy today on Radio Times with Rachel Poliquin. She's a curator and writer, author of a book called The Breathless Zoo, Taxidermy and the Cultures of Longing. She writes the taxidermy blog, ravishingbeast.com. Also with us is Beth Beverly. She's a rogue taxidermist and artist. She's the owner and proprietor of Diamond Tooth Taxidermy, which is in the Kensington section of Philadelphia. And we have posted some pictures on our webpage at whyy.org/radiotimes. You can see some of Beth's work, and you can see some of the photographs in Rachel's book as well. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Jennifer from Philadelphia to join us. Jennifer, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi
there.
Hi, this is an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
What it made me think about was when I went to art school, I was in the sculpture department, and there was a bunch of guys who were always bringing in, like, dead parts of animals to work with in their sculpture. And it kind of freaked me out, and it freaked out one of my friends, and she kind of dubbed them, you know, the dead animal department, and just sort of laugh about it every once in a while. But I never took them very seriously. I thought they were just kind of, I don't know, odd. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, you know, does Beth know any other people who are really using animals, you know, and parts of animals in their art?
Oh, sure.
My comments up there, I think.
Thanks a lot, Jennifer. Beth, you want to add to that?
Sure. I have actually had people contact me about getting dead animals to paint. There's a good number of still life painters who like to paint, you know, pheasants in a dead pose hanging along with, you know, piles of fruit. But aside from that, no one I know personally.
But also in your book, Rachel, there's some photographs. There's one of a lion carcass, and then looks sort of like entrails, but not exactly, from about half of the body on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a Dutch duo known as Idiots, and they use animal parts and usually recombine them with items from every day. So they've put sort of a hedgehog on wheels. And that piece that you're talking about is Ophelia, and it's a lion that, as you say, kind of descends into these blobs of gold. And animals, the use of animals in contemporary art is a really popular trend.
Well, and Beth, we're also talking about fashion here. I mean, and looking at your work, headpieces, bridal headpieces, hats, you're wearing some jewelry as well. I mean, it seems that a number of artists are incorporating taxidermy in their work.
Oh, I thought she meant just using, like, rotting dead.
Oh, no.
I'm sorry. Yeah, it seems like it's very popular. If you just do a search on Instagram or any kind of social media for taxidermy, you're going to get hundreds of young artists who are incorporating bones and fur and maybe even secondhand taxidermy, like, chunks of something that they can use into jewelry and hats, so...
I saw a picture of you, I don't know, maybe it was at that AMC event where you had on your head, it looked like, couldn't tell if it was a deer or some kind of animal that you had on your head. What were you wearing?
That was a baby goat fetus, actually. It was, I have friends, I get almost all of my specimen from a farm. And when it's birthing season, it's only natural that there's going to be some casualties. And this little goat just didn't make it. And so it was delivered to me still in its embryonic sac and everything.
Wow.
And so it was a really tender. That's actually my favorite piece I have right now, is just because it never really got to live. And now I feel like it can live with me. On my head.
On your head. So I saw the goat's face, and then what? There's some leg? I mean, use the legs to sort of keep it on your head?
He's on a little, it's kind of a frame. It's an antique hat frame with some green ribbons. And so it's perched upon that, and then his two front legs are kind of peeking out, and he's resting his chin on his little hooves.
So if you wear taxidermy, I'm curious, what do you do for Halloween when you really have to, you know, make a broad, bold statement?
Halloween is for the amateurs. I'll just stay home and I'll let everyone else have that one.
Right. Because for you, it's, I mean, this is just part of what you, I don't want to make a big deal about it, but this is just part of what you do, right?
It is. I think... You know, wearing your art is a way to, I think how you decide to present yourself to the world is, it says a lot about how you want to engage and how you want your day to go and how you want people to interact with you and respond to you. And so wearing a piece like that definitely generates a different kind of energy than a day if I just feel like wearing a t-shirt and blue jeans.
Sure. And if you're wearing this goat fetus on your head, how do you want people to respond to you? I mean, what do you, I can imagine you get a broad spectrum of responses, but what are you looking for?
Curiosity. I think the kids, children are the best with pieces like that because they're so curious and they don't really have any preconceived notions formed just yet. So they just love to reach up and touch and get a better look. And I like it when people are curious and fascinated. And like, obviously, I know it's not for everyone. And I expect some people to be kind of a little squeamish or a little, you know, put off by it. But everyone, for the most part, has been very polite.
Hmm. I find it interesting what you say about children is I curated a taxidermy exhibit in Vancouver, Canada, where I'm from. And the exhibit included this historic collection that the museum actually had, that they used to have all these animals and they put them into storage and no one knew that they existed for the past 50 years. And so I took them out of storage and I put them on display and just to have a conversation about what taxidermy is, what was its history, what should we think about it now. And the museum was so concerned about children. Hmm. They were worried, like, should they put up signs saying children shouldn't come into this, don't see this exhibit. And as you say, it was the kids that absolutely loved it. They loved getting so close to the animals.
Well, we are talking about taxidermy today in this hour of Radio Times. That's Rachel Poliquin, author of The Breathless Zoo, Taxidermy and the Cultures of Longing. She writes the taxidermy blog, ravishingbeast.com. Beth Beverly is a rogue taxidermist here in the Philadelphia city, owner proprietor of Diamond Tooth Taxidermy, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Choose PA Wind supports WHYY and encourages energy consumers in Pennsylvania to power their businesses and homes with energy from in-state wind farms. More on clean, local wind power online at choosepawind.com/Philly.
On the next Fresh Air, Zubiquity, the astonishing connection between human and animal health. We talk with Dr. Barbara Natterson Horowitz about what the animal world has to tell us about human health and sexuality. She's a cardiologist who consults at the Los Angeles Zoo. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The story of the Boston bombings as an act of terrorism put our nation on edge. As authorities continued their investigation, citizens have been asked to stay strong. But that's hard to do when we have felt so much. On the next Voices in the Family, psychologist Dan Gottlieb explores a sense of vulnerability that stretches beyond Boston and discusses ways to transcend this national trauma. Join us for this very special program today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
The Arts and Business Council of Greater Philadelphia supports WHYY and is proud to honor Klaus Oldenburg, winner of the Ann Darncourt Award for Artistic Excellence, and 9 other leaders, innovators, partnerships, and volunteers at the award celebration on May 8th. Artsandbusinessphila.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. If you have any questions, comments, or stories about taxidermy, this is the place to call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Ryan from Newark, Delaware. Ryan, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty.
Hi there.
I had a question, but I wanted to comment real quick on what you were talking about earlier about fashion and taxidermy. And I just wanted to say real quick that I was studying abroad in Paris 2 years ago, and we had a class in feathers, and in the bag of feathers was a taxidermied pheasant head. Hmm. And everybody in the class was terrified to touch it, but I was like, I have to have this, and I ended up making a hat with the feather, with the pheasant head, and I absolutely loved it. It's like my favorite thing in the whole world.
That's great.
But, no, I had a question for your guest. I was curious, I don't know very much about taxidermy, but I was curious, do you guys keep the bones inside the object, or do you leave them out and then stuff it? And then if you do take the bones out, what do you do with them? Do you keep them and make other things? Do you just throw them out? Do you sell them? What's that process like?
All good questions, Ryan. Thanks for the call. I'm tossing that to you, Beth.
Sure. It varies for every kind of project that you're working on, but for the most part, generally, with birds, you keep the skull in because the skull is directly attached to the beak, and you want to obviously keep the beak. So, and usually the wing bones and the leg bones. Some people, when they're working on mammals like foxes, they'll build their own mannequin and with armature and excelsior and clay, and so they will keep leg bones in. With small mammals like that, for the most part, when I'm working on things like that, you can order pre-made mannequins. They're foam, and you can kind of alter them to fit whatever needs that you may have, or you can even carve your own entire form out of foam or make a mold. There's many different ways, but as far as bones, if it's an interesting bone, I'll save it. I've just gotten into they're called baculums, and they're called penis. They're penis bones, and they're actually really popular now. And I find that I just on a whim started putting some up on Etsy from raccoons and different small mammals, and people really respond to it. They
like
want them.
Like as necklaces or just as ornaments?
As necklaces and charms. And there's a whole lore behind the raccoon baculum. It brings fertility. If a woman is trying to conceive, she should keep it on her person at all times, and it'll bring her a baby. And also, if you're a gambler, you wrap a $10 bill around the baculum and take it out with you to the casino, and you're supposed to win big.
Guaranteed?
I'm not going to guarantee.
No, I got you. Ryan, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Rachel, let me go back to you. And in your book is an amazing taxidermist, a guy named Walter Potter. Tell us about him.
Walter Potter has become probably one of the most famous anthropological taxidermists. And what that means is he set little animals up into scenarios doing various things that no animal's done before. So his most famous piece is the kitten wedding. And there's 18 little kittens, and he made little clothes for them, a little wedding dress, a little wedding ring. He's got the bunny schoolroom, and they're always scenes of sort of summertime pleasures, generally speaking. They're kind of drinking, they're playing croquet, there's a band, and they're
delightful, really.
They're delightful, but there's of course a darker side to them. The little kitten wedding, as creepily cute as it is, those kittens were all drowned.
Oh goodness!
Because that's the way that they treated excess kittens on farms back in the when we're talking about the late Victorian era. And the squirrels, there's kind of documented of where he gets all his little animals from, but they're generally speaking, they came to him in a deceased state for, not being where they should be. And then another really famous one is, it wasn't done by Walter Potter, but Edward Ward, and it's the squirrels boxing.
And it's a whole kind of box of boxes of squirrels boxing.
Boxes, and so it's kind of meant to be seen sort of cinematographically, where each one is the process of them continuing the fight until one squirrel finally knocks the other squirrel out, yeah.
Theatrical taxidermy,
yeah.
Called. Beth, speaking of where you get your animals, as you said, for the most part, you get it from a local farm or a farm not, in the region or something like that.
Correct. I try to only use animals that have died naturally or for food. So I've struck up a friendship with these two guys who have a farm in upstate New York, and they have hundreds of chickens and goats and pigs, and they just got some peacocks. And so they have a giant freezer that they keep all of their deceased in for me, and I'll make the trek up there every so often. And through them, I've met other farmers, and the circle keeps growing.
But did you do this because you learned sort of the hard way that they were sort of speaking about what Rachel was talking about, that, you might have worked on animals that had been killed for some reason?
Well, I never wanted to have any animals killed specifically for my craft. Because I got into it because I love animals so much, and I have pets. I have two cats and a dog, and I would hate to think of drowning any kittens.
Terrible.
So I understand that there are circumstances. There are farmers who trap foxes when they're endangering their coop. But it's a very tricky ethical ground to navigate. But for the most part, I just try to stick with. And legality-wise, chickens are great because there are basically no laws protecting.
Oh, really?
Chickens, because they're just a domestic animal. But anything else, songbirds, waterfowl, a lot of waterfowl is protected. And importing and exporting, you have to have just a ton of permits and licensing, and it's a lot of paperwork.
Let me get back to our callers. We have, it looks like, Tony from Bucks County joining us on Radio Times. Tony, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I've been privileged to be involved with taxidermy my whole adult life, and up here in Bucks County, I have the world's largest glass eye manufacturing company.
Really?
And so I've been able to watch taxidermy change even dramatically within the last couple decades, and I'm fascinated by this program and your guests. And from my perspective, I'm able to see not only how it's changed within the traditional taxidermy community, but also how it has branched out into other art forms, and how it's inspired other people to sort of use taxidermy in their art, not as the complete focus of their art. So I'm really curious about what your guests have to say about that.
Yeah, in fact, Tony, that's sort of what we have been talking about, which is the many ways that taxidermy has been incorporated into fashion or art or culture. Anything you want to add to that, Rachel?
Well, there's a huge movement in the contemporary art world to include taxidermied animals in certain ways. And I think it really speaks to a lot of our new relationships with the natural world and some of our concerns with it. A lot of the contemporary art speaks to issues of conservation and species loss. It speaks to issues of what it means to be a human, whether how we treat the animal world. So it really brings up a lot of our issues in that respect.
You include, I guess it's a famous taxidermy, Arab courier attacked by lions at the Carnegie Museum of Natural History in Pittsburgh. And it is just frightening and dramatic, this taxidermy, I guess, diorama.
It is. It's an incredible, violent spectacle of these two lions attacking and killing a camel with its rider. And it's very much, it's from 1867, And so it's very much a piece of colonial propaganda, where you are meant to see the violence of those lions and the barbarousness of them, and it's sort of you projected the romantic, barbarous, violent nature of that colonial frontier. It was, I mean, a lot of taxidermy comes from an age before photography and before film, and so this was the early forms of now the Killing Fields of Discovery Channel that we watch.
Let me ask you a quick question, Beth. You mentioned the fact that you have two cats and a dog. Have you thought about taxiderming your pets as some have asked you to do with their pets?
I think about it all the time.
Do you?
Because, we just had a scare with my one cat recently, and so it's something that is currently on my mind, and the way that I've reconciled a decision with myself for that is if and when the time comes, I'm going to freeze them and then give myself enough emotional distance between you know, them passing and me being ready to see what I want to do. Because I'd like the option. I don't know if I would want to stare at their face every day.
I was wondering about that. But or have someone else do it for you?
I would never have someone else
do it. No, you'd want to do it yourself. interesting. But do you think of yourself as a surgeon in a way?
Sometimes when I'm cutting through various tissues and ligaments, I do have this acute sense of anatomy that I can't help but see in other animals or other people when they're moving around, and I just think, oh, that's the ligament that you would sever to cut that bone off, and so it is a little surgical in that sense.
Let me see what looks like Glenn from Sicklersville has to say. Glenn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes, thank you for taking the call.
You're very welcome.
I just want to ask your guests two questions. First of all, how do animal activist groups have responded to her positively or negatively? And as far as art goes, the art form of taxidermy, where do we stop? I mean, I've actually seen tours come through Philadelphia where human taxidermy has become popular as art and as entertainment. I mean, is there some sort of ethical line we shouldn't cross in the name of art?
Well, Glenn, you're referring to an exhibit that was in Philadelphia, a lot of other cities, where these were human bodies, where you saw literally how they were put together. I don't know whether, Rachel, you saw those or not.
Yeah, the Body Worlds exhibit.
Exactly.
In some ways, that's the exact opposite of taxidermy, whereas taxidermy is just the skin of an animal, which is repositioned into a lively way, that you've actually peeled the skin off in order to see all the muscles and the flesh that, as Bev was saying earlier, is removed with taxidermy. Yeah. And in some ways, the Body Worlds is sort of a textbook come to life. And it doesn't, despite the fact that the humans are in sort of lively positions, they don't create that fantasy of liveliness or that fantasy of encountering an animal which is still alive, which is what taxidermy is really all about.
Have you had to deal with animal activists, as Glenn put it?
I do get hate mail occasionally, but it's, for the most part, I've been very fortunate. And when people do, I allow comments to be posted on my blog. If people want to voice their concerns, I have no problem allowing that material to stay up. I just think I'm comfortable with my own ethics, and it's obviously not for everybody, so...
You were on this AMC show called Immortalized. What was that like for you?
It was a really fun experience to kind of switch gears from, you know, biking around the city and going and doing my work by myself in a studio all day to being on a sound set in Hollywood with people dressing me and putting makeup on my face and doing my hair. And it was kind of just like a living doll experience for a little while. And it was super cool to have someone hand me a budget and say, here, make whatever you want. We trust you. And it was, I think, as far as getting a little more respect for taxidermy in the general populace and showing people that it's more than what they might think it is, was the show was so great for that.
And was there, it was a competition, right?
Correct.
So did you win?
Yes, I was victorious both times.
Let me get back to our callers. Looks like we have Linda from Medford joining us on Radio Times. Linda, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Fine, thank you. I was listening to the story, and it reminded me of when I was in Steamboat Springs, Colorado, coming down from the mountain in my car, and I thought I saw a domestic cat that was in the middle of the road, and I'm the type that, you know, I go and pick it up and take it off the road so nobody smashes it. Found out it was a bobcat that someone had hit and just left in the middle of the road. And I had my 16-year-old nephew with me, not afraid, got out of the car, took him. I called the authorities, and I said, you know, can I take this? Do I need to turn it in? And they said, no, you can do whatever you want.
Huh.
So I took it to a local taxidermist, and he showed me what he would do, which was skin it, put the fur in a ball, put it in the freezer, send it to New York, have it processed, send it back to him in Steamboat. He let me pick out a form that I wanted the bobcat to be in, and I got it in the mail like 6 months later, and he's beautiful. And this was like 20 years ago.
That's great, Linda. You know what? I'm jumping in here only because we are nearly out of time, and I just wanted to give Beth Beverly a chance to respond, and I'm assuming in part this is what happens to you, right?
Well, I wish that I could just pick up a bobcat these days, because the laws have changed and you actually need a permit to pick up roadkill, and you have to. That's why when you said that you called the authorities, I was kind of shocked that they said just take it, because these days you have to have permits and you have to pay certain fees for even roadkill.
Linda, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I hate to end on the note roadkill, but we do have to end our discussion. Beth Beverly, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
She's the owner proprietor of Diamond Tooth Taxidermy here in Philadelphia. Rachel Poliquin, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, my pleasure.
And she's the author of a book called The Breathless Zoo, Taxidermy and the Cultures of Longing. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. In fact, go to our webpage and you can see photos that we have posted there about taxidermy. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Heather Bromfield, our intern. Emily Bryant helping us out this week. The program produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.